Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough.
And I'm Tim Pierce.
And today we are doing a fundraising episode of In the Hive. And that's because it has been our fall pledge drive here at KCPW, and we are working to raise the funds necessary to power this public radio station. And if you are a fan of what we do, we want to hear from you. And you can visit us at kcpw.org to make a pledge. Lots of great thank you gifts you can check out there. And yeah, let's get to it. Let's dig into the clips we've got lined up for the show. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, sounds good. So what today's program is going to be is a sort of best of this past year of In the Hive. So we've all presented, or both of us have presented clips in which we're going to share with you some of our favorite episodes.
Yep, favorite parts of In the Hive from the past year or so. And this last week, there's been a lot of news about climate change. Mm-hmm. And in fact, KCPW has been providing a great deal of that coverage, from Greta Thunberg's comments to Congress and to international leaders as well, to the global climate action and how it played out here in Utah. But our coverage of climate issues hasn't been limited to the past few weeks. And in fact, I would argue that it has been a critical part of what we provide here at KCPW for quite some time. As just one example, back in February, I spoke with the climate activist Tim DeChristopher. A decade ago, when he was a student at the University of Utah, DeChristopher was arrested for disrupting this oil and gas lease auction on BLM land. He went into this auction back when there were in-person auctions. They're now all online. And he bid on a number of leases near to national parks and on wildlands in the state of Utah. He eventually served 21 months in prison for his act of civil disobedience. And after that, he got out. He went to Harvard Divinity School. Now he lives in Rhode Island. But a decade on from the action that kind of made him famous, I spoke with Tim about his climate activism, about how far we haven't come since that in terms of actually addressing the climate crisis. And the background here is that year over year, humanity is actually emitting more greenhouse gases, burning more fossil fuels than ever before. And that's despite the science telling us that we need extreme measures to stave off disaster. One of the things that I asked DeChristopher was what regular people should do when faced with that reality. And we've got a clip here with him replying to that, and then just a little bit more of the show.
The first answer that I come to is that regular people, when faced with this issue, grieve. And I think that's an important part of our response at this point, you know, that it's not 1992 anymore. It's not even 2008 anymore, when everyone was saying this is our last best chance to stop this crisis. You know, the task ahead of us 10 years ago was incredibly daunting. And now it's far beyond what is even thinkable, really, for us to respond to this crisis. And all of the science over the past decade has gotten worse. And we've already started seeing those impacts in really real ways, both here and around the world. And so I think there's an internal transition that we have to be going through to grapple with that reality and to be able to hold the paradox where we have in some ways lost the fight, and yet the fight is more important than ever, where we have to be able to grieve for what has already been lost and what we've already committed to losing. And at the same time, we need to fight harder than ever to try to minimize how great that loss will be.
To some extent, DeChristopher is talking about the world he and others in the climate movement were trying to save versus the world that is now possible to save. I asked Tim about the continuous but largely ineffective measures to shake people, and perhaps more importantly, government leaders, awake to the reality of the diminishing returns from delaying action on climate change.
You know, we have to admit at some point that we don't have an answer to that question, and that when that's our task, when that's what we seek to do, is wake people up or whatever, we're going to fail, and we're going to be brokenhearted, and we're going to feel like completely useless. And I think it's far more empowering and perhaps more effective, rather than ask the question of what can we do to get other people to change, to look at ourselves and say, what do I feel a moral responsibility to do at this time and with this information that I know? And that responsibility for us is not dependent necessarily on what others do. Other people's ignorance does not justify our inaction. Like, we know what we are called to do on some level. And going about doing that without an expectation that we're going to change other people's minds, I think, is not only the only way to do this and maintain our sanity, but also, paradoxically, usually more effective at actually influencing change.
Some comments on grieving, some comments on basically doing the right thing anyway. And again, that's Tim DeChristopher, who engaged in an act of civil disobedience, something that he knew was illegal, but he believed was righteous nonetheless. And that's when he disrupted an oil and gas lease auction here in Utah 10 years ago, from a conversation that I had with him in February of this year. That's the kind of conversation you can get on KCPW. And this is our fundraising In the Hive episode, where we're highlighting some of the favorite parts of the show that we think are valuable, and we think all of the show is valuable, but this is just a compilation of greatest hits from the show. And if you appreciate it, we hope that you will make a contribution. And Tim Pierce, how can listeners make a contribution?
You can go online to kcpw.org.
That is correct. And now, Tim, you have some clips as well lined up. What have we got lined up coming up next here?
I do. Okay, so the first story I produced for KCPW was a profile on the environmental activist group Civil Riot. And this was actually sort of the first in-depth profile that was released on them. That being said, City Weekly and Peter Hoseland for City Weekly released one. They published one shortly after we broadcast our show. And that is very good, and you should still check it out. He did great work.
Yeah, I agree.
But still, I think with KCPW, and we really do try to get these engaging ideas in, and there's conflict even with our own community. And I think that everyone, especially those in power, have a powerful stance in a position. So basically, just what I'm trying to say is we try to get both sides, whether that's, you know, both sides of the aisle or through our reporting here. And so really,
yeah,
I think the main premise of our Civil Riot story was looking at the ideological impasse between those who support the inland port and those who are against it. Because if you recall, this was back in June when this story first aired, and this was after Civil Riot shut down several of the Inland Port Board Authority or the Port Board Authority meetings. One of their leaders, Ethan Peterson — he wouldn't like to be called a leader, though.
No.
He wouldn't like that very much. But he does get a lot of media attention. He's quoted a lot. And he was arrested shortly, and then I interviewed him actually like the next week. And anyway, so here's a clip from that story. I really think the ideological impasse that we highlighted here, we're still seeing today, right, with the global climate strikes today, and how people sort of criticize Greta Thunberg because they just don't see the same world that she sees.
And this isn't actually Ethan Peterson we're hearing from, though, right, to start with?
No. First, we're going to hear from oil and gas lobbyist Jeff Hartley, who is a proponent of the inland port.
All right, let's take a listen.
He says there's ways to make the port smarter, to divert traffic, trucks, and trains that don't need to be in the city outside of it. But those conversations aren't really happening right now. To be perfectly clear, the state has not yet said what exactly the inland port is going to look like. There's no plan, just plenty of potential. But none of that is concrete. So that's why Hartley says conversation on just what to do with a port are so integral right now. But the discourse surrounding the inland port is too heated, too caustic, and that's stalling conversations that could introduce compromise and smarter solutions.
There's a way to sit down and have a healthy dialogue about what should be done, what protections to put in place. I work with companies that have impact on the ground all the time, mining companies, oil and gas companies. We're required to mitigate and minimize our impact. We're required to do reclamation that meets standards that are set by the government and others. That's part of the process. There's a way to make it cleaner and better. It's going to happen anyway. If you're part of the dialogue, you get to help make it cleaner and better.
For Hartley, the state is growing at breakneck speeds, not just economically, but in population. And there's no possible way that all these people growing up in Utah can get jobs to provide for their own families without some sort of new economic driver. So Hartley says the inland port is non-negotiable. The only way to make it a better project is for people to engage in the discussion in a proper, civil way.
If they think their voices are being heard when they handcuff themselves to doors and scream and yell, those voices don't get heard. if you're not part of the rational conversation between adults, you really don't have a voice. They can scream and yell all they want about climate change. This isn't the Inland Port isn't a debate about climate change. It's a debate about we have logistic issues today. We're shipping goods today. We could increase distribution and services out of Utah and create a lot of jobs for people today. And can you? The question is, can you do that and minimize your impact on environmental issues? We haven't had those discussions yet.
But Civil Riot and Peterson say they've tried to have these discussions. They've voiced their concerns, played by the rules, and the Port Board members haven't engaged.
There's an imbalance or dissonance between Civil Riot and the Port Board. Not because one is evil and the other is not, but because, to Civil Riot, the future the Inland Port brings for Utah, that growth and economic boom, is unsustainable and there is no compromise.
We shouldn't be growing. We need to be scaling back. We're destroying the planet. If we continue to grow, eventually it stops. And when that happens, we're going to have actual violence. I mean, I know we're getting criticized for being violating decorum right now, but when food and water shortages stop, what do you think happens? That's when people start killing each other. So right now, our thing is pretty much we're willing to take misdemeanors and felonies and potentially go to jail in the coming years because we don't want people to be killing each other and starving.
And again, you're listening to an episode of In the Hive, or part of an episode of In the Hive from earlier this year. That was a coverage of the Utah Inland Port and the divide over the Utah Inland Port. Tim, I think you covered that very well. A really interesting episode to go and check out. A reminder to listeners that we are in our fundraising season here at KCPW. This is part of our fall pledge drive. And we are here to highlight some of our favorite parts of this program In the Hive, and then also to encourage you to support this local independent public radio resource. We are your community source for news and ideas, and we cannot do this without the participation of our listening audience. Again, you can contribute at kcpw.org and do your part that way. And Tim, yeah, you have this look at, you know, the divide over the Utah Inland Port. I actually have another clip here that we aired back in July after a pretty intense protest over the Utah Inland Port at the offices of the Salt Lake City Chamber. And this actually wasn't for In the Hive. This was something that we aired on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Go ahead.
Which is another one of our local programs
that you should also support by going to kcpw.org and making a pledge. A couple hundred protesters came to this particular action, and it was a very loud protest. Eventually, police came and dispersed protesters. There were some minor scuffles, that is, between police and protesters. Arrests of people engaged in civil disobedience who had locked themselves into the actual offices of the Salt Lake City Chamber. And I suppose that I should mention that the reason that they targeted these offices was because Derek Miller, who is the president of the chamber, is also the Utah Inland Port Authority Board Chair. That's the word I'm looking for. This clip, which is a compilation of audio that I gathered at this protest, was just to give a sense of what it was like during that news roundup behind the headlines. And you can hear that it was pretty intense. And the clip begins with Ella Mendoza, who is one of the protest organizers. I caught up with her just after it had broken up, and we'll get her reactions to what happened, and then we'll hear some of the sounds of the protest as it played out. Let's give a listen. Why was this so big, and how did it come together?
So we had folks, indigenous water protectors and land defenders, come here and gather with us from many, many different places and regions. Some folks that have been fighting border militarization because we told them about the port and they were just so angry they couldn't believe it, that this thing is getting built in our backyard and nobody will listen to us. So this is our call to action. We want people to take action and to understand that this fight is bigger than just an environmental justice narrative. This inland port will affect communities on the west side. It will affect folks with migrant issues. It will affect folks from all corners of the region. This is a fight that involves all of us. And so we did a call to action, and we had local groups, local student groups, local folks with all sorts of different ideas and ideologies, as well as indigenous folks that were in town. And we all decided to gather. because this fight involves all of us.
How about what happened with police today?
Police are pigs.
And you had some arrests?
We did.
How many?
I'm not sure. We don't have numbers for you yet, but we will release another statement.
My name is Sarah Stock, and I'm a local organizer with Kenyan Country Rising Tide, a climate justice group who works to confront the root causes of climate change. So we're here today at the Chamber of Commerce to target Derek Miller, who is the chair of the Port Authority Board. And the inland port would lead to a major increase in fossil fuel export and production in the state of Utah. So we're really concerned about that. And Derek Miller has the power to stop the inland port. So we're here to try to put pressure on Derek Miller.
My name's Karen Pickett. I'm actually from the Bay Area in California. And I'm out here meeting with other environmental activists. And so this was happening, and it seemed an appropriate time and place to come out and show solidarity. I'm with Earth First myself.
Okay.
And we have many of the same issues, you know, in the Bay Area. Environmental issues, I mean, environmental justice issues.
And again, the sounds of a protest at the Salt Lake City Chamber's offices back in July over the Utah Inland Port. A number of protesters that I spoke with there were visiting from elsewhere, participating in a rally by the environmental group Earth First that happened to be taking place in Utah at that time. And, you know, just for us to be able to gather and present and just go out and witness news events, we need your support to get that audio, to have the equipment necessary to go out and do that, and then... yeah, to be able to broadcast this signal requires your participation. And if you appreciate what we do on this program, on Behind the Headlines, or on any of the other local programs that you hear on this station, you are an integral part of our being able to do that. So please do your part right now by going to kcpw.org and making a pledge.
Even sounds of a protest are so powerful. If you could not attend yourself or you did not know what was happening, I think you did a really good job with that postcard of just getting the feeling of what it was like to be there. And I think it's important to know that this sort of event is happening in your community. Like, this is going on right next door.
Yeah, this and sort the of, whys and hows and who's involved and the conflict at the heart of that matter, which we've also been covering, I think, a lot, both on the show and elsewhere on KCPW, the development of the Utah Inland Port.
Right. So if you support this work, please consider making a pledge by going to kcpw.org.
All right. Next up, Tim, we have a clip from a show that you and I co-hosted together. I think it was maybe our first co-hosting adventure?
No.
Okay, I'm wrong. Fact check from Tim in the moment. But this was a show we did on recycling.
Right. And the question we originally posited on social media was, and what we really wanted to know was, how much of what you put into your blue recycling bin actually gets recycled?
And that turned out to be a very difficult question to try and get to the bottom of. And I encourage you to check out the full episode to hear the answer. It's a little bit convoluted. I mean, some of it has to do with market forces. It can vary year to year. It can vary minute to minute. And it's just a really difficult question to get answered. Go ahead.
Sorry, it's not a quantitative value, but it's still an important answer, I think, that we give.
Yeah, I agree. The clip that we're going to hear, though, from this episode is from Roland Geyer, who is a professor of industrial ecology at UC Santa Barbara. Geyer was the lead author on a study published last year in the journal Science Advances that did something that had not been done before, which was to look at plastics on the global scale. And basically, this was an investigation looking at how much plastic has been created since we started mass producing it, only about 6 decades ago. And then what happened to all of that plastic? And the central finding of that research was pretty stunning. Let's take a listen.
Historically, we found that since we started to produce plastic and the year 2017, a mere 9% of all the plastic that globally produced were recycled. Historically, overall, 67 years or so.
9%. We've recycled just 9%.
Yeah. And again, that's between the birth of mass production of plastics in about 1950 until today. Only 9% of all the plastic ever created has been recycled. If you look at the current rate of plastic recycling worldwide, Geyer says we might actually be recycling somewhere around 16 to 20%, but it's still just a fraction of what gets used and sloughed off into our environment. And a lot of plastic is being made right now.
So right now, global annual plastic production stands at about 430, 440 million metric tons. That is, and you know, for many people, that may not mean a lot, but it is an incredible amount of material. If you compare it to other material, it's like 4 or 5 times as much plastic as we produce something like aluminum, which of course we also make an awful lot of.
Dr. Geyer from UC Santa Barbara says that there's a bit of a crisis going on right now. And he gave me kind of a primer on the dangers of plastic pollution for environmental and health reasons. And, well, it's not a pretty picture.
You know, what we know about the plastic that we're currently mass producing is it does not biodegrade. So, however, sunlight and other environmental forces break it into ever smaller pieces of plastic. So that's kind of what's happening in the environment. So we just now find plastic in big, small, and even nano pieces everywhere where we look in the environment. So we have some widespread pollution of plastic, and the environmental ramifications are not entirely clear at the moment. I mean, we know it gets into the food chains at all trophic levels, right? Big fish eat it, small fish eat it, shellfish eat it, worms eat it, krill eat it. So everyone's eating it. So we know it ends up on our dinner plate as well. It's found in drinking water. It's found in the air as microfibers. We know we're breathing in microfibers by the thousands. It's important to know that plastics is not just a polymer, but it's about 7-8% additives. Those are very complex chemicals, some of them toxic. So they get into the environment, you know, they piggyback on the polymer, get into the environment. So we don't know what the long-term implications of that are. And at some point, I like to invoke what we call the precautionary principle, basically. If we don't know, but we think it might be bad news, you know, like maybe it's better to just, you know, err on the side of caution.
So a pretty stark look there at plastics in our environment and how they impact us, and how we don't know exactly how they necessarily impact us on the health level, but also what is happening around the globe in terms of plastic production and how much, again, year over year is being produced. It's really an interesting story, and I think one that was valuable. Check it out at kcpw.org. While you're there, please do your part for this local independent public radio resource and allow us to keep doing what we do by pledging. This is our fall fund drive. I'm Roger McDonough.
I'm Tim Pierce.
And you're listening to a best of edition of In the Hive. And we're kind of winging it here. We've got some clips.
And we're
playing them because we think that they are indicative, representative of the kind of work that we do here. And you've got something coming up here, Tim. This is a show that looked at the Glen Canyon Dam and the Colorado River, right?
Yes. So the story that I did was the second part of another story I did on the aquatic invasive species that were plaguing the waters of Lake Powell.
Quagga mussels.
Quagga mussels, correct. And I wanted to look at Lake Powell and sort of the overarching Colorado River system. But as I was digging into it and doing this research, I was learning sort of what are some of the mechanisms that keep... what is the rigid system, what is the law of the river, and why is it so strict, and why is it so hard to do complete reform, like bust down Glen Canyon Dam. And so I talk with Marlon Duke, who is the public information officer with the United States Bureau of Reclamation, and he kind of dug into the 1922 Colorado River Compact, which is an incredible, important history.
The water sharing agreement between the states.
Exactly, the water sharing agreement between the states, and that kind of tells us why we're stuck today in this gridlock. And so let's check it out.
All right, let's hear it. And again, you're listening to a Pledge Drive edition of In the Hive. Donate at kcpw.org.
The 1922 compact calls for a flow of 75 million acre feet over 10 years, over every 10 years, flowing to the lower basin.
That's Marlon Duke with the Bureau of Reclamation again, by the way.
And then another 75 million for the upper basin. The lower basin, though, is a demand-driven structure in the compact, whereas the upper basin is a supply-driven.
Okay, so that probably doesn't make any sense, so let's break it down. There was an agreement made in 1922 that divided up the water in the Colorado River. Writers of that agreement, including representatives of all seven states in the Colorado River system, looked at the northern states along the river, which were much less populous than some of the southern states at the time, and said, "Hey, we know you have access to the water first, right? Rivers flow down to the ocean. Everybody knows that. It's 1922. So it would really suck if you took all the water in this river for yourselves and didn't share with your southern neighbors, because there are a lot more of us than there are of you." So the states in the upper basin, which are Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and New Mexico, have to send down a certain amount of water to California, Nevada, and Arizona, which are in the lower basin. Then what's left after what gets sent down, the upper basin states get to keep. So time passes and states in the lower basin start to build reservoirs, like Lake Mead, the reservoir formed by the famous Hoover Dam. And states and cities use the stored water, much of which comes from the northern states, to supply water for drier seasons. Like we mentioned earlier, Las Vegas gets 90% of its water from Lake Mead.
Have you ever stopped to think of all that has to be done before you can get this water to scrub your legs?
You get into the late 1940s and early 1950s, and the upper basin states...
Of course you know that the water comes in pipes.
...start looking a little bit nervously at the river.
The pipes run down under the house. If you follow one of them, you'll find where it comes from a larger pipe outdoors.
And saying, you know what, they have all these storage facilities down in the lower basin.
And this pipe will lead you to a big water pipe in the street. Do you know where this water comes from? For many people, the water comes from a reservoir.
We don't have that up here. Where that starts to make people nervous is, what happens if we start getting into some of these years where the river doesn't have as much water, and the upper basin states just have to watch that water flow by because they have a legal obligation to make sure it gets to the lower basin.
So the Glen Canyon Dam that created Lake Powell was built in order to hold the legal obligations that required the upper basin to deliver a certain amount of water and to make sure the delivery didn't take all of the unused water from the northern states. Duke says that if the Glen Canyon Dam didn't exist, if the reservoir wasn't there during the drought to meet its legal deliveries, then the situation in the lower basin would look a lot worse.
If you run the numbers and you look at how much water we've released from Lake Powell and how much water they've used in the lower basin, if Lake Powell hadn't have been there in 2000, Lake Mead would be dry today.
And another example of the kind of reporting you can hear on KCPW from my co-producer here, Tim Pierce, who's in the studio with me.
Yes.
Tim, I really enjoyed your look at the Glen Canyon Dam, Lake Powell, and the Colorado River system over a series of episodes here on In the Hive.
Thank you. You can check out all of our episodes on kcpw.org. And while you're there, why not make a pledge? Support independent local public radio.
And you have been listening to a Pledge Drive edition of In the Hive from KCPW. And this is a listener-supported independent public radio resource. We can't be here without you. Again, that web address, kcpw.org, to make a pledge. Thanks for listening.